Okay, so thanks for the nice introductions, and then I really appreciate the many of you actually to come to the very early sessions of the Saturday mornings. And what I would like to introduce is actually one of our recent work regarding the deep directed generative models. But before I actually get my talk started, maybe I would like to first introduce some of the idea of the generative models compared to the discriminative models. And there has been worked for many, many years, actually. So for a certain period, and the people focus on the discriminative models. And then after that, the generative model again, and the back to the discriminative, and sometimes a hybrid generative and the discriminative model. Still, actually, we cannot really say which model is better than the other, but it depends on the applications and the problems. But the recently, actually, the generative model has been combined with the idea of the, some of the deep hierarchy, which produced some of the deep directed generative models. So recently I have interest again on the deep directed generative model, which I'm going to introduce today. So this is the typical the deep network. Okay, so it could be the fully connected network or the convolutional or the recurrent network. The idea is actually to take the data at the bottom. Take the data from at the bottom layers, okay, and the, all the information flows in the upward. And at the top node, and then we compute the error, and then the gradient of the error is back propagated to tune all the parameters in the middle layers. Okay. So the back prop has been popular for many, many years, and then the recently the popularity of the deep learning also excited the back propagations again. But if we reversed all the connections in this way, so there are some the stochastic or the hidden variables in the top layers, okay? And then information flows going toward the bottom layers, and at the bottom layers, and then we compute some errors, okay? So in this case, okay, so from the hidden curves, and then we generate the data, but we observe the data, so we can we are able to really compare our generated data with the actual training data. We might be able to compute a certain error according to the certain measures, and then error is propagated upward. Okay, so it's the other directions, and this has been actually the proposed a long time ago, about the 20 years ago. By one of my colleagues working in the physics. And the benefit of the up propagations will be, this can be trained in unsupervised fashion, actually. We don't need actually to label the data. In the discriminative case, we should have the labeled data, maybe except for the autoencoder, but in general, okay, so this has been designed for the training with the labeled data. But up propagation is actually, we just convert the connections, the error of the connections, and then we just convert it to the generative models, which can be trained by the up propagation algorithm. So the derivation of the algorithm is rather straightforward and very simple extensions, but this is really nice work. So in the first slide, actually, I would like to introduce some early idea of the up-propagation algorithm. So this is the discriminative, and then this is the generative. Okay. So in abstract ways, and all the time, okay, when I teach the graduate students the machine learning, and I say, okay, so all the machine learning model can be categorized into only just the two models, either discriminative or the generative models, okay? So the shaded, the node is observed node, and the blank node is actually unobserved, or the hidden, or the latent variables, okay? So the discriminative model directly parameterized the conditional distributions, which is actually P of H given V, where H is hidden and V is observed. And the generative model is the other way, and then we could model the joint distributions over the observed or the hiddens, or the conditional the distributions over the observed variables given the hidden variables. So the distinction between the discriminative and the generative is just a matter of actually the which distributions we parameterized. But this typically the working better for the with the labeled data, and the generative models is working better with unlabeled data. So the sometimes we could combine these two models together to improve the maybe the performance of the semi-supervised classifications. So in terms of the generative models, and then we have a long history, and then we started from the linear generative models, where we assume the observed variables is modeled as a linear transformations of the latent variables. And it depends on actually what restrictions we impose on the latent variables, and then factor analysis or the independent component analysis or the non-negative matrix factorization. Those are actually can be categorized into the linear generative models. And a very long time ago, I was working on the independent component analysis. So maybe I can say that I'm very familiar with the linear generative models. And let me skip. Okay, so for the the earlier idea of the independent component analysis, okay, so we infer the independence assumptions. And what people really hope from the generative model is typically the distributions of the observed data is very complex, okay? So if we are able to learn the certain generative model where the latent variables follow the very simpler distributions, which can be parameterized by very small number of parameters, and then we might be able to extract some the concept or the hidden information, and that's the really underlying idea of the generative models. And so in order to really extract some of the semantic space from the observed data, and the people impose some independence assumptions for the latent variables, and then that's the idea of the independent component analysis. And a long time ago, then people applied this idea to the set of natural image, and then this is the basis extracted by the ICA, which resembles actually the characteristics of the receptive field. And then there was even more than the 20 years ago. And also the non-negative matrix factorizations, actually we imposed on only just a non-negativity constraint on the latent variables, and then we were able to really extract some of the parts-based representations, and that's another idea. Okay, so in fact, actually the long time ago, and then we looked at the problem of the NMF. But the NMF is rather the shallow model. So in year 2004, which is a long time ago, and then we extended the idea of the NMF to the multi-layer fashions. And then this is, okay, so I told you that the NMF is actually can be categorized into the generative models. So each layer and the connections in each layers are the restricted to be the non-negative, and all the values of the hidden node and observed nodes are also the non-negative as well. So the idea of this up-propagation is follow the idea of the traditional propagation algorithm for the multilayer the network, but up-propagations, each up-propagations follows the multiplicative updating, just like the algorithm of the NMF. So we say that's the multiplicative upprop. But at that time, the DIM network was not popular, so we didn't really attract the many attentions. But we were able to show, actually, if we train this multi-layer network where all the connections are restricted to be the non-negative, and that we were able to really extract a certain hierarchical representations given a bunch of face image. So at the bottom layer, which you see on the left, and extract some very simple the features, but the gradually at the top layers, and we were able to really more abstract the features. Just like a convolutional neural network, but this is not a convolutional neural network. But still, we only imposed the non-negativity constraint in the multi-layer network, but we were able to really extract the hierarchical representations. So that's just the first half of my talk. And then now actually I'm moving to the deep directed generative models. So maybe the many of you are aware of the some the deep directed generative models, which includes, for instance, the variational autoencoder or the generative adversarial network. But I would like to pay attention to the variational autoencoder, which is nothing but just actually the density network, which was proposed by the David Mackay long time ago. So this is the typical the generative models. Okay, so we prefer to use this the generative models where we model the. Where we introduce some of the latent variables to explain the observed data. So the z is the latent variables and x is observed variables. And then this is the given z and the distributions over x is actually the conditional likelihood. And also maybe translated as a probabilistic decoder. And then the inference is rather hard in general, okay, so even apply the variational inference, but for the shallow model, maybe we are able to do the variational inference, okay. But we would like to introduce some of the deep hierarchy in this the network, and then the inference becomes harder and harder, and also in general, even the variational inference and then the complexity is proportional to the number of samples. So the more samples coming in, and then we have to redo the inference and inference again, so which is not a good idea. Okay, but in the density network, okay, the proposed by Mackay, and then they introduced some inference network, okay. So the inference network is controlled by the global parameters. In such a case, despite the number of samples, and then all the inference is controlled by the global parameters. So in such a case, maybe the inference becomes easier. Okay, compared to the old idea, and the seminal work was done by the Kingma and Maxwell links, and sometimes this is known as amortized the variational inference. So the inference network is the critical, and sorry, this, okay. All right. Okay. So. This is some of the two popular algorithms, and the one is a variational autoencoder, and the other is actually the generative adversarial network. And the variational current autoencoder is actually the density network, which is very close, based on actually the probabilistic model. And the generative adversarial network is not, unfortunately, the standard and old idea of the generative adversarial network doesn't have any inference part. But they are able to learn only the distributions of the training data. But the later, actually, some the more elaboration has been done to introduce even the inference network and the generative adversarial network. But the inventor of both popular algorithms are working in currently in the OpenAI. And then a couple of the applications of the deep directed generative model is actually this slide is taken from the Shakil Mohammed, and for instance, if we train the generative models by feeding the bunch of image, and then the model figure out so how the image are generated. So in such a case, even the half of the image is just occluded, but still the model is able to really figure out what the remaining image will be, because the model were already seen the many different image, and then they already figure out how those images are generated. And also the people made a few efforts to improve the image generations using the deep directed generative models, and still the accuracy and how close the generative image to the actual the image, and still the improvement has been made for past couple of years, but still some of the people are working on these problems. Okay, and also even the maybe another applications is a one-shot generalizations. Okay, but this has been done by somebody else, so maybe let me skip because of the time limits. Okay, so the back to the variational autoencoders, and then the consider the generative models, and then the critical part is here the inference network. Okay, but what I would like to introduce is. So this is a slight the modifications of the standard variation autoencoders. So in a standard variation autoencoder, actually, they parameterize the probability decoder using the Gaussian distributions with the diagonal the covariance. Okay, but in such a case, actually, so they assume that actually the disconditional distribution is independent. But we realize that actually we slightly change the parameterization. So in other words, the probability decoder is a Gaussian with the centered at the mu, but the covariance is something like actually this is the perturbed the rank one the covariance, and then in such a case actually this. Slight change of the parameterizations help us to really better capture the data manifold. And then, in fact, actually, we showed that this can be interpreted as the infinite mixture of the principal component analyzers. So this works better than actually the standard variation autoencoder because they captured some of the statistical dependence through the the rank one covariance structures. But what I would like to introduce in the next few minutes is, in fact, okay, so this is the simulations, and then this is the data, and then this is the modeled by the variation autoencoder. But using the diagonal covariance and not able to really well capture the data manifold. But if we introduce some the rank one covariance structures, then we will be able to really better capture the data manifold. But what if we have some? So far, I focused on only just the real value to observe the data. But the sometimes the observed data might be. Some mixed data, so some of the attributes are real valued and some of the attributes are the categorical variables. In such a case, how we can really capture the dependence and also extend the idea of the variational autoencoders to model the mixed, the categorical and then the real values. So the capturing the statistical dependence and one of the earlier idea and then easy to do is actually use the couplers. Okay, so for many of you who has no experience in the coupler is actually the coupler is nothing but just the distributions on the unit curve with each unit variate marginal distributions is actually the uniform. So in other words, so f of x1 through x sub d, and so we have some d-dimensional attributes, okay? And then the capital F represents the cumulative distribution functions, okay? So the cumulative distribution functions over the d random variables can be represented by the coupler functions of the each the marginal CDF, okay? And so for the continuous case, and then the density functions can be represented by the copula density followed by the product of the marginal the density functions. Okay, so there are some the several well-known copula functions. It's just like in the kernel machines, and then we assume the certain type of the kernels to convert the nonlinear problems into the linear problems. Here, actually, we assume the certain type of the coupler functions to convert the dependent variables into the independent the cases, actually. So we introduce actually the idea of the coupler, and specifically we use the Gaussian coupler to the variational autoencoders. So in fact, we have some the ordinal the categorical variables, and then the real valued the variables, okay, and then the everything else will follow the similar idea of the variational autoencoder. So we extend the variational autoencoders to model the mixed real valued and then the ordinal the variables, okay, and then we follow the some the stochastic variational Bayesian ideas to do the inference, okay. So yes, this is the toy data in the UCI repository, and which has some the continuous the variables as well as the ordinal the discrete variables, and then maybe the likelihood is has been improved, and probably I'm running out of time. So this is all, and I would like to say and thank you.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be here. It's an honor to present at the MSRA Faculty Summit, and we have not been working too much with discriminative models. Our research focuses around topping modeling, the latent Dirichlet allocation and the hierarchical Dirichlet process, those two models, which are very representative of the generative view within machine learning. So this dual context topping model is still a very generative model, but it sort of combines it brings a small piece of neural word embedding, which is not necessarily generative. So this is our sort of slow entrance into this world of using neural network models for analyzing text. So this work is mostly done by my graduate student, Jun Kim, and he's actually looking for a postdoc position, if you're interested. So he was working on Bayesian nonparametrics for a while, and then we noticed with topping modeling, for those of you who may be a little bit unfamiliar or coming more from the image side of machine learning, let me introduce briefly what it is. It's just basically a statistical model, a generative model, or the LDA and the HTP topping models are generative models for discovering latent thematic structure from unstructured data, most frequently text data. We use LDA and HTP for finding topics, so sort of one way to explore a topic, a text corpus, such that you have a better idea of what are the underlying semantic themes that pervade this this corpus that you have. And you know, as you know, it's been heavily researched in the last decade or so. Most of you probably know, but this is a graphical representation of what we wish to find using a topping model. So you have a large corpus of text data for which you have very little metadata, for example, which topics are actually in each of the articles. And the basic assumption of LDA and HTP is that there are a few major topics within a single document. So in this particular example that we have, which is about this biomedical venture company being sued for some fraud. So the pervading themes in this article are biology, startup, and law. And for each of those topics, we have a multinomial distribution over the entire vocabulary, and each topic is usually represented by the words with the highest probabilities in that topic. So for example, biology has the words lab, blood, medical testing, and experiment as the top probability words, and so on. So the objective of the LDA model is to find these topics. So without being given a priori what are the topics and what are the words that are highly likely to happen in each of the topics, the model actually discovers those topics and discovers the probability of each word being in each of the topics. Okay, so in to sum up again, we're trying to explain documents in terms of topics, and we're trying to explain the topics in terms of the words. But the problems, so I did this introduction to point out some of the problems that we wanted to resolve by introducing the neural word embedding into it. So the first major inherent problem with topic modeling, or with the LDA model, is that the local context of each word is just totally ignored. So when you have a word, when you have the words in this particular sentence, for example, it says partner fund management, a San Francisco hedge fund, all of these words occur together in this small local context window. But the LDA model and the HDP model does not care where the word occurs within a document. It could have occurred as the first word in the document, or the last word in the document, or somewhere in the middle. They're all treated the same way. But it does consider the document context. So the document context in this example we're showing are the three topics: biology, startup, and law. So each word in this document is only represented by the document context and not by the local context. The second major inherent problem with the current way that these generative topic models are being used is that we consider the words as the smallest unit. So we look at the document in terms of the topics that each document is made up of. We consider the topics as the set of words and their probabilities, but we don't really care what each word is. So it's, for example, if the word legal is there and there's another word law, they're semantically very related words, but in this, in the basic LDA and HDP interpretations, those words are just independent. There's no relationship between those two words that are being represented in those models. Okay, so we devised this new model called dual context topic model, and we call that dual context because we consider the local context of the words as well as the document context of the words. And the overview is like this. We take an article, we take a document, as you see on the left side there, and we represent it as a network. So as a graph, if you will. So where each of the nodes is a word, and the connections are some kind of relationship between the pair of words that are linked. Okay. So I'm going to tell you in a few slides, or maybe in the next slide, or in a couple of slides, how those links are made. But once you have the document represented as a graph like so, then we can actually run, or we can actually do a very similar thing that the LDA does. So the LDA, what it does is it clusters basically words based on the topical sense, right? So we cluster the words law and fraud and legal and lawsuit all into this one topic. It's not really clustering, but you can look at it as a clustering task. So in this dual context topic model, what we do is we actually look at the links between the words, and we say that the links actually belong to the topics, not the words themselves. Okay, so for example, if you have a link between, it's really hard to see the words. Okay, so let's say in your text, you have, in your graph of this document, you have a link between the word legal and lawsuit. Okay, so then that link becomes a token, if you will, that we put into a topic. Okay, so that's the overview of the model. And let me explain how we build this graph of the document. So we look at each word. So for example, we're looking at the word fraud, and we look at the neighboring words. Okay, so being accused of securities fraud by a major investor who, so all of those neighbors are potential candidates for having a a link between between the pair of words. Okay, so with this word fraud, all of these are the potential candidates, and then we look at the similarity of these words based on a neural word embedding. So in our work, we just use Word2Vec. We use SkipGram with negative sampling, so which is the most popular type of word embedding these days. But it really doesn't matter what the details don't really matter too much. But if you run word embedding, for every pair of words, you can get a similarity score, okay, within that vector space that we embed the words into. So then just by taking that similarity score, we look at the words that have high similarity and that are in the neighborhood of that word that we're considering. So we're considering the word fraud, and if you look at the neighbor sued, fraud and sued have a very high similarity score because apparently, obviously, they have very high semantic similarity, as opposed to something like major, right? So, I mean, we're gonna ignore these words that look like stop words anyway, like who and has. But if you look at the word major, that's not a stop word, but you can see the similarity is not that high to the word fraud. Okay, so then, but then it's over the threshold. But we do look at changing the threshold to see which words actually get to actually have the link between fraud and that word. So I am highlighting in bold the words with high similarity, and so we make a link between those two nodes, and that's how we take a document like this and turn it into a document graph that you saw before, like so. Okay, so that's the output of what I was just describing. Okay, so that's how we make the document into a graph. And then this is the generative model. So as I said, this is not really I'm not really going into the discriminative world. We're still in the generative model. So this is basically the generative model for LDA, except we're actually looking at drawing the topics for each link that you have for between words, between pairs of words. Okay. So And inference, because of the short time we have, I won't really describe the inference because it's not really different from how we do inference for LDA. You can do Gibbs sampling, MCMC-based sampling, or you can do variational inference type of inference. So I'm just going to describe the experiments that we've run and the results. So this is a very much text modeling type of work. So we do visualization of the topics, and we look at the words that are bridging words. This is kind of interesting. And then we do quantitative analysis. We haven't done perplexity yet. I'm not really sure. This work is kind of preliminary, as you can see. But we do look at topic coherence as a quantitative metric, and we look at document classification. So the data sets that we used are the New York Times articles, and CiteSeer, which is an academic corpus, of course. And for document classification, we use CiteSeer, and the six classes that we use are as follows: agents, art, AI, and so on. All right, so this is how you can actually visualize the topic. So let's see, this is an article from CiteSeer, and it's about reinforcement learning. As you can see, the words multiple, multi, single, acquisition, cooperative, agent, learning, reinforcement, and so on. So there are two major themes. One is about reinforcement learning, which are the blue links, and then another topic that we see that we've discovered here is about agent learning. But as you know, as in the regular LDA model, these topics are discovered from the entire corpus, right? And then for each document that we have in the corpus, we can discover the major themes in that topic by the different clusters or different topics that each link belongs to, okay? And then here's just another example. This one is actually about some database query language, and there's one topic that is about language, or this is programming or query language, and then there's one about optimization. And you can see that what's interesting is you can see that words like meaning, for example, meaning is up there on the left. It has links to other words, and one of the links is blue and one of the links is red. So that tells you this word meaning can be representing two different topics within that document. And one is about the descriptive query language and the other is about this optimization. So what we did there, what we noticed then is there are these words that sort of act like bridges between different topics. And so with the New York Times articles, we specifically looked at these bridging words. So if you look at this topic, for example, city, has words like city, housing, building. And then up there, we have the environment topic, environmental, water, waste, and so on. And then there's a bunch of words that can go in either topic, depending on the connections that it makes to the other words in the documents. So you can see development, storage, state, Jersey, this is from New Jersey in America, environmental, waterfront. Those words can belong to the city topic or the environment topic, depending on which other words that we're looking at together with that. Okay, so I think that's an interesting bit that illustrates very well that our model considers the local context, which the LDA model wasn't able to do before. Okay, so how much time do I have? Oh, okay, so I'm almost done. Topic coherence is one metric that people use a lot in topic modeling. So basically saying that our model DCTM does better than LDA in topic coherence. We've tested this a number of times with different corpora and that works well. The last thing that we did is word prediction. So basically we take an article, we take every document and we delete one word, and we're trying to predict what word that is. And you can see, because we're using neural word embedding, which is supposed to capture these local context and predict words in the local context, our model does quite well. But even compared to Word2Vec, because we're considering the topics as well as the local context, we outperform both of those models. And the last thing, this is the actual last thing that we do, is classification. We do document classification, but we actually corrupt the word order. So we use the exact same words, but corrupt the word order. So you can see our document becomes this, which is very illegible. But then we can do document classification with corrupted version, and this is how LDA does on the original documents, this is how DCTM does on the corrupted documents, and this is how DCTM does on the original documents. And so you can see, in a way, you know, this is almost expected. We're just using a lot more complex model. DCTM, as you can see, uses Word2Vec, and it's a complex model and has many more parameters. But after actually doing that, it does perform better than better than LDA and Word2Vec for these tasks. So basically, we decided to try to merge the advantages of the generative topic model with Word2Vec, and we just tried to, you know, overcome the limitations of the two models, and as a result, it improves upon the regular results. And the last thing I should say is, you know, word embedding, there's generative word embedding, there's a ton of, or not a ton, but there's some papers coming out that try to combine topping modeling with neural networks. And I think it's a very interesting field to get into, so we're sort of slowly going into that direction. There's still a lot to learn about. There's still a lot of unknowns. So I think that if you're interested in this field of work, we should talk. And yeah, thank you.
Thanks TM for the last introduction. Okay, so this is Tao Xin from Maxwell Research Asia. So today I will present our work about an efficient deep algorithm for text generation. Okay, so maybe it's not a standard generative model, but it is indeed for text generation. If you have attended yesterday's session about machine translation or deep learning, you will find that recurrent neural networks have been widely used for text generation. For example, in machine translation, given an English sentence, we want to generate another, maybe Chinese or Korean or Japanese sentence, which is a translation of the original English sentence. And also for conversational bot, if a user says something, we want to generate a sentence to response to the user's input. And also similarly for image or video capture. Okay. So the one major challenge for the application of recurrent neural networks for text generation is the efficiency and the scalability challenge. So here we take a language modeling task example to demonstrate this challenge. The task of language modeling is to assign a probability to a sequence of words. We want to assign a large probability to a natural sentence. We want to assign a small probability to a sequence of random words. So actually, this task can be decomposed to assign a large probability to a correct word at each position, as shown in this figure. So you can see that given the word what at for the position, we want to assign a large probability to the word is for the second position. Given the what is in the first two positions, we want to assign a large probability to the word the for the third position. We want to assign small probabilities to what other words for the third position, so that we want if we only give the first two words, we can correctly generate the third word. So on and so forth. Okay. So here is an unfolded form of the graph for recurrent neural networks for language modeling. Here is a very simple math for the equations. Okay. Basically speaking, we embed each word into a vector space, and we use a word embedding vector. We will use a embedding vector to represent this word, and then for the position t, we generate some hidden state based on the current input xt and the previous hidden state ht minus 1. Okay. Then we, based on this hidden state, we want to predict the next word. What we are doing is that we use another output embedding matrix v. So v is of a large dimension. Usually it's row number, it's a number of words in your vocabulary. Okay. Then we can get a score vector o. So here, O is a with a dimension of a number of words in your vocabulary. So O is a score vector. Each dimension of vector V is a score we assigned to one word in the vocabulary. Then through a softmax operation, we can compute a probability for each word for the next position. Okay. So here we need the dimension of those parameters for this RNN model. Here, I think the two major components is input embedding and also the output embedding. These two parameter matrices are of very large dimension. Number of rows is vocabulary size, and the number of columns is either the embedding size or the output embedding size, the hidden state size. Okay. So, let's take some public data set example to show the large model of the RNN model. So here we take the CLUWeb as an example. This is only partial of the data set. It contains more than 100 billion tokens, and the vocabulary size is more than 10 million. Okay. And so we can analyze the size of input embedding and output embedding. We can see that if because we have more than 10 million words, we need 10 million vectors for embedding. And if we, the embedding size is 1,000, we use 4 bytes to represent a float number, so that the total model size will be larger than 8 gigabytes. So this may be not a big issue for CPU training, but if we want to conduct GPU training, because GPU is usually much faster than CPU, so then it's far beyond the capacity of today's GPU memory. Okay. We will show some numbers later about today's GPU memory. We also analyze the computational time, the running time to train an RN language model. So we also take this data set as an example. So here, the main complexity is we need to compute the hidden state for each position, and then we need to compute a score vector for each position. Okay, remember that this vector is huge dimension. If we have 10 million words in the vocabulary, so always the vector we of the dimension of 10 million. Okay, so because V is a large matrix, this computation, I mean for each position, this computation is about 10 billion float operations. Relatively speaking, so the computation of the hidden state is much smaller. Then if we look at the today's mainstream hardware, okay, so we show the CPU, GPU, okay, so we at least three models of GPU, K40, M40, I think they are widely used in our research or industry applications. Right? So you can see that for memory, for GPU, it's, of course, it's not a big problem if the model size is 8 gigabytes. But for GPU, the nice GPU has the memory is only 24 gigabytes, so it's much less than our model. So, and we also analyze the training time. So here, because for this data set, we have about more than 100 billion tokens, and So because for each token, the prediction takes more than 10 billion float operations. So this is 10 giga. And if we go past the data for 10 epochs, and we need to conduct the forward and backward propagation. And so here we divide by the computational capacity of GPU. Here we take K40 as an example. So we have 30 seconds and 300 seconds per hour and 24 hours per day. Then we need rough, so this rough estimation, we need to take more about 200 years to train our model on this data set. I think we cannot afford such huge training time. We cannot wait for so long time. Therefore, we must to handle this model size challenge and also the bigger computer challenge. Here, our proposal is to adopt two-component shared embedding. Okay, the basic idea is that we allocate word words into a table. So each row of the table is associated by a row vector x, and each column of this table is associated by a column vector y. So that by doing so, we can see that for each word in the table, it will represented by two vectors, two components. The first one is row vector, and the second one is column vector. So we can see that for generally, we use the vector x1, y1, the concatenation of these two vectors. We use a large vector to represent this word. We can see that doing so, word words in the same row will share the row vector, and the word words in the same column will share the column vector. So that for vocabulary with V words, we only need two times the square root of V embedding vectors. Comparing to the standard approach, in standard approach, because we represent each word by an independent vector, so that for vocabulary with 10 million words, we need 10 million embedding vectors. But for our for this two-component shared embedding, we only need several thousands of embedding vectors, so we can greatly reduce the model size. Okay. Based on this two-component shared embedding, we propose a new RN algorithm. The structure is very similar to standard RN, but the only difference is that to predict or to generate a word for one position, we need to make two predictions or two generations. For the first prediction, we need to predict the row vector or the row number for the word. And in the second prediction, we need to predict the column of for the word. So if we have determined the column and the row of the word, then we determine the word. So in previous approach, we only need to do one prediction for each word. Okay. So that's the difference. Actually, our new algorithm is much more efficient in terms of both memory and training time. So we call it Night Iron to reflect its memory and computation efficiency. So here we have some detailed analysis about the model size for our Night Iron. So here you can see because of this kind of two component shared embedding, we only need a square root, two times the square root of V embedding vectors for the input, and also this number of vectors for output embedding. Then overall, we can reduce the model size from 80 gigabytes to only 7 megabytes. So it's a huge compression by a factor of more than 1,000. Here we also analyze the training time. Because for this, for the output score vector, we have two score vectors. One is for the column, and the other one is for row. So that we also greatly reduce the number of candidate rows and the candidate columns. So that we can reduce the computation from the 10 billion in previous RN approach to only several mini floater operations. So that we can reduce the training time in the same GPU hardware from about 200 years to only 2 months. If we have multiple GPU, we can further reduce the time to maybe several days. Okay, it's affordable. Here, we can reduce model size and the training time, but we have a technical challenge for Night Iron training because we have the word embedding, the word allocation table. So we need to optimize both the allocation table and the Iron parameters. We design iterative training methods for Night Iron. At the very beginning, we could start the word allocation table. For example, we can randomly initialize the word allocation table, but in our experiments, we allocate the words into rows and columns according to a prefix and the suffix. And then we, given the word allocation table, we train the RN model by minimizing optimizing the loss function. And then once the RN parameters is optimized, then we fix the RN parameters. And then we further change, update the word allocation table so that we can further reduce the training loss. Once the word allocation table is updated, we further go to this step to continue training the RN parameters. Here we show how we update the word allocation table if the RN parameters have been fixed. Actually, this is it is equivalent to a bipartite graph meshing problem. In the bipartite graph, one side is all the words in our vocabulary, and the other side is all the positions in the table. So we want to match each word in our vocabulary to each position in the table so that we want to minimize the matching loss. This problem has been widely studied in previous computer science or algorithm research, so we can directly apply those methods for our task. We conduct many experiments on several public data sets. Okay, because in this work, we use two component shared embedding. So we also call it two component, two CR, because actually we can also try, for example, three component or even more component embedding. But since we have already significantly reduced the model size, so we only try the two component shared embedding in our experiments. We should do experiments on more than 10 data sets, but here we only report three data sets. Two of them are of middle size, and one of them are of relatively large size. So here we first report results on these two middle size data sets. So you can see that in terms of model size, we can, because the vocabulary is not so large, it's only slightly larger than 100,000 words in the vocabulary. In terms of the model size, we can compress the model by a factor of about 3, okay? But interestingly, we are checking the accuracy of language modeling. Usually, perplexity is used to evaluate the accuracy of language modeling. Smaller the accuracy, better, smaller the perplexity, better the accuracy. So we can see that on the both the data sets, our method after bootstrap means that we refine our word action table. We can achieve the best accuracy compared to a previous method. We also check the training time, how much training time compared with the previous approach. Note that here HSM is a hierarchical softmax. They also want to speed up the training process of RLM, but it is at the cost of reducing or hurt the accuracy. You can see that we do not list the accuracy of HSM in this table. Okay, so we find that we are for our light RLM or 2C RLM, we are much faster than HSM. We to achieve the same accuracy, we only take less than half of the training time of HSM. Please note that HSM is already a speed up algorithm for a longitudinal RLM. We also check how much time the word table reallocation takes over the total training time. It only takes a very small percentage of the training time. Here we report the results on a relatively larger data set. It crosses 1 billion benchmark. This data set is released by Google. It contains about 1 million, slightly less than 1 million, 1 billion tokens. And the vocabulary is about slightly less than 1 million words. Okay. For this data set, you can see that we compress the model from several gigabytes to 40 megabytes. So you can see that, okay. We significantly reduce the model size. The accompany ratio we achieved is about 100. Okay. So for such a small model, it's very easy for our application, for example, using mobile device or any other kinds of device. And also we check the accuracy. Compared with the previous best accuracy, we can improve the accuracy. This for the first several results, we compare with the single model results. We are better than those results. And also we compare with the ensemble method. Here, ensemble means that we ensemble those RN deep neural network results with traditional n-gram results. So we can see that our results are still the best. Actually, if we have even larger vocabulary as we aligned size in previous slides, if we have more than 10 million words, then the model comparison, the model can be compressed by a factor of more than 1,000. Okay. So here we show some results. Maybe it's not, okay, so maybe it's too small. Okay. Basically, we can find some pattern because we just randomly allocate the words and optimize the word allocation table through the optimization. We can find some patterns. For example, in this row, word numbers are in the same row. And also for this one, those numbers with some, with those fractional numbers are in the same row. And this is another row. You can find what the URL, what the website address are in the automatically allocated to the same row. Here, okay, so this result may be more clear. We can see some patterns, those numbers or locations, they are in the same row. Okay, so as a summary, in this work, we propose an efficient deep algorithm for text generation. Because the standard RN can be applied to many text generation tasks, so our light RN can also be applied to those tasks. Actually, the basic idea can go even further. For any predicting task, if we have a large number of possible output categories, because, for example, for those web page classification or face recognition, we have 1 million categories, we can apply the similar idea to reduce the model size and speed up the training. Okay. So, in summary, NetRN have several advantages. First, it addresses a big model challenge for GPU training. We enable the training with very large vocabularies on single GPU device. And also, if we want to conduct training on multiple GPU or CPUs, we reduce the communication cost because for a very small model, its communication cost is was very small. Okay. And also, we enable the training of RN models on FPGA. FPGA usually have a much smaller memory than GPU. Third, it enables the utilization of RN models in mobile devices. Because only small models can be fitted into limited memory of mobile devices. Otherwise, if you think that an app needs to use several gigabytes memory, I think it's unacceptable for our users. Okay. Yeah, so I will stop here. So I'm happy to take any questions.